This is Mayo Clinic Kids, a podcast from Mayo Clinic where we discuss the latest pediatric research and recommendations to help keep your kids laughing and thriving. I'm Dr. Angela Matke, a pediatrician with Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
This episode, ADHD. When you hear ADHD, there's probably a specific kind of kid that comes to mind. The hyperactive boy who disrupts class. But that's just one version of ADHD.
So recently, I came across a case that was referred to me with the question of anxiety, especially anxiety related to school. 15-year-old female wanting to do well at school, but just struggling for whatever reason and worried about meeting expectations for parents, but even more so meeting expectations for herself. And as the school year started, found it increasingly more difficult to turn in assignments or as mounting missing assignments. And people had kind of attributed this to like, oh, she's just overly worried. She's not turning in assignments because she's hyper-focused on doing the right thing and redoing assignments so that they're perfect in her eyes. But as I got to work with her and understand more, this was not a new problem for her and had really been there for quite some time. But no one had ever really thought of ADHD, right? Because her grades had been pretty decent up until this first part of high school. But as we went back and we explored younger years, there were certainly times that in elementary school would need to be prompted to turn things in, had lost a lot of items both at home and at school, but never to the point that it was getting in the way of the things that she was involved in. And so she was probably off task long before she came to my attention, but hadn't really caused a lot of disruption or trouble. So people had always just seen her as, you know, quiet and doing her own thing, but not having any impairment from it.
Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, or ADHD, is a four-letter acronym we've all heard of. And it's incredibly common. Pretty much every classroom has at least one child with ADHD in it. Maybe it's your kid's best friend, or the kid they sit next to, or maybe it's your kid. But Americans throw around the term so casually, it's easy to lose track of what ADHD actually means. We might know the basics, trouble paying attention, getting distracted, or hyperactive behavior. But some of those things are also part of just being a kid, or even an adult. So let's get to the bottom of what really defines ADHD and what a diagnosis could mean for your kid. What are the medication options and what are the risks? What can you be doing at home to support your child? Should your kid be getting special accommodations in school? And what about the impact of labeling a kid? To help us figure it all out, we're talking to Dr. Eric Peace. Eric is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Mayo Clinic and also an assistant professor of psychiatry with the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and Science. Eric, thanks for joining us. So to get started, let's talk about attention and the brain in general. When we look back on evolution, there's probably a really good reason why our brains allow us to be distracted.
All of us need to pay attention to more than one thing going on in our life day to day, right? Think about this, especially as you're a parent, you're thinking about what's for dinner, who needs to get where tonight, what's coming up tomorrow, is that permission form due tomorrow or Friday?
Right? So describing these, my life.
All these thoughts are going through our head day to day, and there's too many things that demand our attention in our day-to-day lives for us to do those one at a time. So we have to functionally process multiple thoughts, multiple needs all at once. What I just described is certainly much different than it looked like evolutionarily, where you need to be hunting and gathering food, but aware of your surroundings for some type of predator or danger in the environment. But even modern day, there are still things that are distractions and pulling our attention in umpteen different directions that we still have to remain attentive to and on track.
And all that multitasking that you just described in my life is exhausting and the brain needs rest. So what would happen if we didn't and we just tried to be like a machine and be hyper-focused and hyper-productive all the time?
The brain is just like any other part of the body in that it's going to have some type of threshold that it's reached its max capacity. And we know that rest is really important for the brain to restore and get the energy that it needs to consolidate the information that it's taken in, move it from that active thought to memory storage. So you have to give that brain a chance to rest and reset. And if we just keep pushing, at some point we're going to exhaust the capacity and kind of run out of gas and not be able to really attend to anything.
So when it comes to attention, what part of our brain is in the command deck, steering our focus one way or another, and how does that work?
So the area of the brain that is most responsible for attention and shifting focus from one task to another is probably the frontal lobe. And we know that this is the area of the brain, it's probably the slowest to develop. So often why we see ADHD present early in childhood, because that is the most underdeveloped part of the brain. So someone is prone to having ADHD, they just can't keep up with the thoughts or kind of the various things demanding their attention until that part of the brain evolves over time, or we intervene even pharmacologically to help that area of the brain function a little bit better.
So our brains aren't fully developed until we hit our mid-20s, maybe a little older for boys or men as well. So as a kid's brain is really growing and developing, how does their attention span change during that time?
As we get older, our ability to attend to multiple things should become greater, especially as we think about that part of the brain developing further. Adults can probably attend to multiple tasks a lot smoother than a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old. I think we think about things like sitting still throughout a show or a movie, or even like a presentation. That's going to be a lot harder for a 5-year-old to do than a 15 or 16-year-old to do. Mm-hmm. And even kind of multi-step instructions, right? If you give a 16-year-old 3 steps, go to the store and then pick up your brother from practice and then drop this off at the neighbor's before you come home, they should be able to keep track of that many things. Mm-hmm. Versus if you gave that many steps to a 5-year-old, you might see one of them get done.
Or none.
Right? Yeah, or none. Depends on your 5-year-old. But yeah, the capacity that we have to acquire things that require more attention is going to grow as we get older.
So putting ADHD aside for a moment, let's remember the world is a busy place. Life requires a lot of mental gear shifting and prioritizing and reprioritizing. Everyone's brain is constantly trying to find a balance between focus and managing distractions. The frontal lobe is what allows us to do that. And like the rest of our kids' bodies, it grows and matures over time, meaning our kids' ability to focus and remember and prioritize will increase too. So while you might be wishing your kid could sit through the latest Disney movie, that expectation might not be realistic depending on their age. Now let's talk about ADHD and how to determine when a kid might need a little extra support. So everyone struggles with staying focused to some extent. Kids aren't great at paying attention or being able to follow these multi-step directions like you had just referenced. How do we tell the difference between whether it's just typical attention stuff or selective hearing that everyone struggles with versus it being something like ADHD?
I think it's all about patterns and things that persist over time and persist across settings, right? So if your kid is progressing through development and still struggling with taking on more tasks, with paying attention, that's kind of reason to raise some concern. If this is being noticed by school, by coaches, scout leaders, and you at home, it's going to be, how is this distraction starting to get in the way? Is this causing conflict with parents in the sense that you're not getting done what you've been asked to get done? Are your teammates starting to get frustrated with you because you're missing practices or even during certain sporting events, competitions, you're literally or figuratively dropping the ball? Because we're all going to be distractible within some spectrum of variance day to day. But by and large, that distraction isn't going to cause frustrations that persist or mounting frustrations with us. Like, why is this happening in almost every setting that my child is in? So really looking for this persistence, not only in the attentional difficulties, but the persistence in the attentional difficulties across multiple settings. But when you see that impairment start to mount, that's probably a sign that maybe that's a little bit more than just your day-to-day distraction.
Is there a specific age or developmental phase where we start seeing signs of ADHD, where it's more than just, you know, a little preschooler struggling to sit still when we need them to?
You know, I get the impression that hyperactivity or impulsivity is probably going to present a lot earlier than inattentiveness. So we'll see sometimes even three-year-olds who go off to daycare or preschool, and they're just a lot more restless or rambunctious than everyone else in the care setting. Mm-hmm. But I think there are a couple key points that ADHD can start to emerge. Kindergarten is certainly one of them, that first year of structured school environment. Third grade is another one because educational expectations start to change, right? And we start learning some academic skills or subjects rather than life skills. And the evaluation is also a lot different in third grade than it was kindergarten, first and second grade. Middle school is another big one, right? Especially for the inattentiveness, because you start to have to move 6-7 times a day. Instead of staying in the same class setting, you're picking up and moving to a different location throughout the day. You got to keep track of belongings or materials required for multiple classes. So certainly the demand on organization and certainly being attentive to that changes when you get to middle school. And occasionally we'll see it in high school or even the transition off to college, though I think if you start to poke around in those cases, there's certainly been a pattern that was probably present much further back than that initial concern.
So what you're saying is, you know, it can come to the attention of teachers and parents and physicians later, but it was probably always present earlier. Mm-hmm. What does mild ADHD look like and feel like? And how does that compare to a child who has more pronounced symptoms or more severe case?
Mild ADHD is probably someone who has difficulties keeping track of things, but for whatever reason, they've been able to come up with a system that works for them, that they can still meet the things that are expected of them. So this might be the person who has multiple post-it notes or stuff written on their hand to keep track of different things that they got to do. Whereas more severe ADHD, regardless of what type of organization system or prompt, it's going to be really hard for you to stay on top of things, to keep track of things, even keeping track of possessions. Mm-hmm. So you try to use a planner to keep track of your responsibility, but then you lose the planner, right?
Are you describing me? No, I'm just kidding.
Kind of the level of impairment and how much intervention is needed to compensate for it is probably what informs that spectrum of mild to more severe.
Yeah. And there's different subtypes of ADHD. We're talking collectively of ADHD as a whole. Mm-hmm. But can you describe inattentive versus the hyperactive impulsive subtypes and then that combined subtype?
So inattentive type of ADHD is the individual who is distracted. It is hard for them to focus on multiple things at once, hard for them to follow those multi-step processes. They often lose things. They might go someplace and forget why they were there, what they were doing, or go into the store for one item and come out to the car without having purchased that. Right. So again, looking at that persistent pattern of that.
Right.
We're all allowed to have those moments from time to time, but it's really the persistent that. The hyperactive impulsivity, this is someone who's really, it's hard for them to sit still. They are always restless. They might be really hyperverbal, talking all the time. Hard for them to wait their turn in conversation. They might not even be listening to the other part of the conversation because they're so focused on jumping in to offer their contribution. And impulsivity, it can range greatly. I think one of the parts of impulsivity that we don't talk a lot about in ADHD is emotional impulsivity. So these are the individuals, especially in children, that have these really large emotional reactions beyond what the situation calls for. You know, as parents or as providers, we see something as pretty benign and the child has this kind of explosive outburst in relation to it. So impulsivity can certainly present that way, but it can also be, you know, leaving home, walking over to the neighbor's house without permission, walking into the neighbor's house without permission, running in the Target parking lot without a lot of regard for the cross traffic of cars. So that can certainly be one of the symptoms that increases the dangers that can be associated with ADHD as well.
And in the teen years, what would some of those impulsive behaviors look like?
We know that driving is certainly one of the areas where impulsivity can present. So speeding, perhaps not being as attentive to traffic laws or stopping at stop signs or even things like lane changing, checking to make sure that no one is there. But we can also see it by being more at risk for things like substance use, or even getting into trouble with the law, misconduct, disruptive behaviors, things like graffiti, stealing, just things that in the moment seems like a good idea, but your thoughts about the consequences catch up to you after the action's already performed.
Kids and even adults with ADHD are also more prone to falling into a state of hyperfocus. What does that mean and what does that look like?
I hear this a lot. You know, I don't understand why they have ADHD. They can play video games for hours. They don't have any difficulties paying attention to things. They just don't want to do it.
Right.
But ADHD, the name is a little bit misleading. It's not necessarily a deficit of attention, but it's more so difficulty managing and navigating attention. So if something's less preferred, it's going to be a lot more effort for you to shift your attention and sustain your attention on that rather than an activity that is desired or even kind of mindless. Hyperfocus, reading is another one. Besides video games, some type of task or activity that people just really enjoy and can get lost in. Just because they're able to do that doesn't mean that ADHD is not there.
Do we know what causes ADHD?
We don't, and we do. There's a couple proposed mechanisms, and largely that is in how medications work. So we think that the frontal lobe of the brain is underactive, particularly with the activity of dopamine. So the medications that we typically use and see effective in ADHD are those medicines that help increase the level of dopamine activity in the frontal lobe.
What about things like too much sugar, TV, or people blame social media for everything, socioeconomic status, all that kind of things? Do we know if that causes ADHD?
As far as causing it, no. Can it make symptoms a little bit more pronounced? Probably. But as far as causing it, that's unlikely.
The number of people diagnosed with ADHD has gone up over the past 20 years or even farther back. What's driving this trend? Do more kids have it, or are we just better at recognizing it and diagnosing it? Or contrary, are we overdiagnosing and overtreating children who maybe don't have ADHD?
I think there's a couple aspects that lead to increasing numbers of ADHD. First of all, we're not very good at tracking the epidemiology of ADHD. It's not necessarily a reportable diagnosis. So some of the data that we rely on is not super valid or super scientific, but we might be looking at the number of prescription medications for ADHD. But we know that the number of drugs that are available in the last 20 years to treat ADHD, that's grown. So that makes sense why prescriptions for ADHD medications would go up. But I also think there's an increased awareness of ADHD, and schools are feeling more confident reaching out to a family and saying, gosh, you know, we notice that your child struggles a little bit compared to other people. Would you consider talking to your pediatrician or your family medicine doctor about this? So I don't know if more kids have it. Do they have it on their problem list? Probably, but that's probably more of an increased awareness. I don't think there's been some environmental cause of the actual prevalence going up. As far as the question about overdiagnosing it, that's tricky. I do think coming out on the other side of the pandemic, looking back, a lot of us struggled with inattention and distractibility when we were pulled out of the setting that we were typically functioning in and needed to adapt quickly to virtual learning, virtual meetings. That was challenging for everyone. So there perhaps has been a little bit of overdiagnosing by pathologizing some of that just normal adjustment. Not that that's not valid data, but really looking at what were things before the pandemic, through the pandemic, and how are we transitioning back to whatever normal looks like on the other side of the pandemic. So we're going to have to look at patterns just outside of that time that we were really restricted during the pandemic.
And I feel like in my practice, there's definitely been situations where making that diagnosis is tricky because there might be multiple factors that can affect someone's ability to focus. What are some of the things that you're looking at to help filter through the lens of, is this truly an ADHD or could this be something else driving the inattention, like undiagnosed anxiety or depression or something else?
Okay, anxiety and depression are the two big ones. If we think about diagnostic criteria for both of those, there's certainly a concentration and attention piece. So it's really important to not chalk it up to, oh, this person has ADHD and that's why they can't focus. And likewise, the other way around, this person's depressed, there's no chance that they have ADHD. So really screening for some of those other symptoms and depression, looking for more of those vegetative symptoms, right? The low energy, the appetite, the sleep changes. Is this something that kind of emerged altogether? How long has the concentration been a concern? So again, looking for that pervasive pattern, or is this something that's really relatively new along with other things? And then anxiety, teasing out, where is anxiety happening around what areas of this person's life are worries focused on? Is it only performance because we can't keep up? That may make me wonder about ADHD more so than worst case scenarios, more of those generalized or situational worries.
Can an undiagnosed learning disability also look like ADHD?
Yeah, definitely. And this is probably an area that often gets overlooked, is if a kid struggles predominantly in reading and they're slow for reading, they might avoid reading because they don't feel successful at it. And we just say, oh, they avoid reading because they're avoiding tests that require that sustained mental effort. This is probably ADHD. We also know that ADHD and learning disabilities travel hand in hand. So just because someone has one doesn't mean that they can't have the other. They frequently come together, but it probably is good to take a look at, are the symptoms really focused in this one subject area? Are they more generalized to this person's entire experience? Because that can help inform even just screening for those learning disorders.
I'm interested in the genetic component of ADHD. Have we been able to identify any specific genes that are associated with ADHD or other heritable factors?
So I'm not aware of any specific genes that we've identified, but we know that ADHD certainly has a genetic component just based on the prevalence that it has in certain families. Sometimes heritability can be upwards of around 80%. If one family member having another family member likely struggling with those same symptoms. We also know that this can arise from just some single nucleotide changes that happen in one's genetics, right? And that can happen up to about 20% of the time. So there may be no family history, but someone can still certainly meet criteria. But when I definitely hear of siblings or parents, even grandparents that have well-documented symptoms of ADHD, certainly much higher on my differential that the child in front of me could be struggling with it as well.
So to figure out if a kid has ADHD, patterns are key. Is this happening in just one part of their life? Or are you noticing similar behaviors across settings? Did problems start because of a recent change to the normal routine? Or is it a long-term trend? And remember, ADHD can look like different things. There's inattention, which means getting distracted and losing track of things. There's impulsivity, like not thinking through the consequences of risky behavior or extreme emotional reactions. And there's hyperfocus. With all these different factors at play, it's not surprising that diagnosing ADHD can get confusing. So pay attention to the patterns and ask yourself, how much is this affecting my kid's success and quality of life? If things do seem off, let's talk about how to get help. All right, let's assume we have an 8-year-old. They are forgetting their planner and forgetting to hand in their homework from time to time, but not all the time. Doing well academically, but sometimes distracted in conversation and has hyperfocus. Where do we go from here, and how do we decide whether this is something that we need to evaluate for ADHD versus this is just normal behavior for a second or third grader?
I think this is really challenging for parents, especially with their first child, right? What is within the realm of normal? If a parent starts to become concerned about this pattern emerging, you know, this isn't just one time we're now on our third winter coat for the season, right? Or consistently late to school, but there's not really another reason, right? Like we drop the kids off at school with plenty of time for them to get into the building and get to class. So making sure that there's not other factors that could be explanations for the symptoms. And if you start to get concerned, I think that's where having conversations with teachers, with coaches to see, is this normal? Like, how is my kid doing compared to others, I feel like they lose a lot of stuff, or it's hard for them to keep up on this much homework. Are other people in the class struggling to get all of this stuff done, or is that not the case? Right? Because you don't want to compare your child to other children, but in some ways, gathering that data can be helpful to see what is it within the realm of normal for an 8-year-old. And that's where, from a diagnostic standpoint, we have a couple standard screeners that we usually use to get that information from teachers, and they're usually really useful informants of the things that they're observing.
I love the idea of talking to the teachers, because as a parent, you don't know if your expectations are inappropriate, right? Comparing to their peers is so helpful because teachers see a lot of kids and they have a lot of general population to compare it to. So you just mentioned some questionnaires. So how do we actually go through that assessment process if I'm concerned my child has ADHD or a parent listening is concerned?
I think the first step is going to be setting up an appointment with your primary care team and expressing some of your concerns. This is something that primary care offices are seeing everywhere and are very well versed in screening out some of those other symptoms or conditions that can mask ADHD or look like ADHD, and trying to establish that pattern, both as far as duration of symptoms, but pattern across multiple settings of symptoms. And then there are some different screener tools that are used, but usually it's a set of questionnaires that parents are asked to complete for the child, and the teachers are asked to complete if your kid is homeschooled or even doing online school, thinking of other people that might interact with your child. Is there a coach or a scoutmaster or a minister, whatever your child's involved with outside of the home, just to get some information, and then bringing that information back to your pediatrician and having a conversation about what those screeners are showing.
And getting multiple perspectives is important because that's part of the diagnostic criteria, right? It can't just be occurring in one setting, because if it is, you kind of wonder if it's really an abnormality in their ability to hold sustained attention and focus, as opposed to it being more of a situational response to the environment. So how is ADHD treated?
The first thing we think about is really the age of the child. So for our youngest patients, those in preschool, the first line intervention is really going to be behavioral interventions. So is there early education needs that can be introduced? Are there some parent management or behavioral management strategies that can be implemented at home or even at school? And then if those are not successful, we think about the addition of medications, and certainly leaning more heavily on medications with our older patients to later elementary school, middle school, and certainly high school. Medications have a really big role in managing ADHD. These are some of the most effective medicines that we have in all of psychiatry. So studies show that these medicines work, and they work really well and are generally pretty safe for patients to take, with the stimulants taking the lead on management of ADHD.
Since these are stimulants and they are a controlled substance, is there a risk for abuse with putting a child on this medication? Parents often wonder if they're setting their child up later in life to be struggling with drug abuse.
I get that question pretty frequently. What we know from the data is that someone is actually at higher risk for drug abuse if they have ADHD that's not treated, rather than if they were to be on appropriately prescribed and appropriately taken stimulant medication.
Another common question I hear are, what are the long-term risks?
There's often a worry about height, or these medications are going to make my child shorter. And actually, the biggest study that we've done on that was done here at Mayo Clinic, where we followed kids through development, looking at their growth over time. And we found that although it may have been a little bit slower at times, ultimately they still reached their full potential for adult height. So I don't want to say that it doesn't impact growth, because it certainly can slow it down, but the end game is still the same. And these individuals end up just as tall as they would have been had they not received a stimulant. And then we have a couple good options for non-stimulant medications. If for whatever reason a family isn't comfortable taking a stimulant, or a child isn't a candidate for a stimulant.
You know, you were referring to these medications as stimulants, and it seems somewhat counterintuitive to give a child who's maybe hyperactive and impulsive a medication that's going to stimulate them more. How do these medications actually help these children?
Really, if we think about what's going on in the brain with ADHD, that frontal lobe of the brain is pretty underactive. So the goal of a stimulant is to wake that part of the brain up or give that part of the brain a little bit more power to be effective in things like attention, decision-making, recognizing consequences, planning, organizing. That's really the goal of the stimulant, is to just fuel that part of the brain a little bit more.
Besides pharmacotherapy or medications, you mentioned behavioral therapy for younger kids. Are there other techniques that can be used to help with attention and focus?
I think just keeping some of the foundational health-promoting things consistent. So things like diet, dietary intake, being consistent with meals, and certainly being consistent with sleep sets someone up for success with ADHD. And also setting families up for success as far as consistency with expectations, with routines, helping someone plan ahead if there's going to be a change in routine. And then exercise is important for all of us, but for those with ADHD in particular, we know that consistent activity can really help them contain their symptoms. It also gives them an outlet for some of that restlessness that they may feel or experience on a day-to-day basis. We don't necessarily favor one exercise over another, as long as there is some form of exercise that is consistently implemented.
I will often have families share with me their concerns about their child being quote unquote labeled with ADHD.
I think the stigma of any psychiatric diagnosis is certainly always there. And that's unfortunate, but it doesn't change the fact that that child still has symptoms. And I often have that conversation with families. I don't care what we call this. I just care that we tackle the things that are getting in the way for your child. So if you need to refer to that as something beyond ADHD for you to feel comfortable proceeding with treatment, that's okay. But we can't neglect the fact that this is your kid's experience and these are the things that are getting in their way that we have to address.
And it can be very validating for kids to actually have this diagnosis and help them understand why their brain works in a certain way instead of us pretending like we can't say the name or the word around them and things like that. Have you seen that as well?
Sometimes it's nice for someone to feel like they understand, like, oh, this is why this is a challenge for me. This
yeah,
is why
exactly.
I haven't been able to keep up or get these things done. And we always have to be cautious, right? Because we don't want the diagnosis to become a crutch.
Absolutely.
Either, where I can't do that, I have ADHD, or you can't expect that of me, I have ADHD. Mm-hmm. The expectations are still the same. It just might mean the way that you take to get there requires more work or maybe just a different approach.
Yeah. Let's talk about in school. Like, are there certain accommodations that can maybe help a child with ADHD thrive and be able to do well in that academic setting?
Absolutely. So depending on the severity of the person's ADHD, thinking about something like a 504 plan or maybe even something like an IEP is very appropriate for ADHD. So a 504 plan is a group of suggestions for teachers and schools based on a kid's needs. So what they do is usually a provider will issue a letter saying this person has this diagnosis and I would support appropriate accommodations, and schools and families come up with a list of some accommodations that they think the child might benefit from. And things that are usually helpful, it can be even as simple as having a preferential seating. Can we be seated in the front of the classroom where it's easier to focus on the teacher? There's fewer distractions. We're not positioned right next to a door where things in the hallway are going to pull our attention elsewhere. But it can also be things like getting a list of assignments that are due for the week ahead of time. Can I get a printout of what's going to be due when this coming week to make sure that I'm able to keep better track of these things? Some kids need more time completing certain assignments or even tests, and some kids do better if they have even a separate environment to take a test in. So is there a separate room that's a little bit more quiet for them to take a test where there are a few distractions that pull their attention away? 504 plans are suggestions, so it's always our hope that those are followed through on, but depending on the class or the teacher, there can be some variance in how those are implemented. Whereas something like an IEP is a little bit more binding. IEP, or the individualized education plan, that's like a contract between a family and a school. And that evaluation process is a little bit more rigorous. So there's usually some formal psychological testing or learning testing that goes into that. Through formal assessment, they're able to determine what exactly that child needs. But not every child with ADHD is going to need that level of intervention. But certainly, if there are other symptoms or more severe cases that a child would benefit from really formal binding academic supports, the IEP route can be the way to go.
And then a common question I hear from families is, can you outgrow ADHD?
I guess the answer is maybe.
Yeah.
So it's not that it necessarily goes away, but does your brain develop enough that you come up with tips and tricks to compensate for the deficits that you have? Mm-hmm. Can you manage sufficiently with the behavioral interventions that you found work for you? Or do you need a little bit of a different approach with the medications being on board?
Do we see a change in the number of adults that continue on stimulant medications, or is it similar to the number that are on stimulants in childhood?
I think the most recent data that I've seen on that is about 1/3 of individuals who took an ADHD medication during childhood continue to take one as an adult. And I do think it matters what occupation you land in and what the demands of your job are.
Mm-hmm.
If you are doing a job that's a little bit more physical, you're up and moving about, demands on attention are potentially different than if you're going to be an accountant sitting at a computer looking at spreadsheets all day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So occupation-wise and where people are called to land, I think can have a big impact on where people land as far as the amount of intervention that they need to manage their ADHD.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us. This was a fantastic discussion.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Diagnosing ADHD is all about behavioral patterns. If you're concerned, talk to your kid's provider. They can start a screening process and help gather feedback from parents, teachers, and other adults in your kid's life. There's a lot of treatment options, and what's right for your kid will depend on their age, type of ADHD, and severity. There are behavior interventions and multiple medication options. And schools are pretty good these days about supporting kids, so make sure you coordinate with teachers and staff. At home, healthy habits and routines, important things for every kid, can also help manage symptoms. Ultimately, what ADHD looks like and how it's treated varies, and it should. The end goal is for them to succeed in their daily life. How each kid gets there is unique. That's all for this episode, but if you have a question or topic suggestion, you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. And we might even feature your voice on the show. For more Mayo Clinic Kids episodes and resources, check out our website at mayoclinic.org/kids. Okay, thanks for listening.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.